Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website, which is www.theorganicview.com. If you have any questions or would like to connect with us, you can simply post a question on our wall on Facebook, send us a tweet to @TheOrganicView, or contact me directly at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. Today's show is sponsored by Eden Foods, one of the most trusted names in certified organic clean foods. Listeners of the Organic View Radio Show can receive 20% off any regularly priced items, excluding cases. Simply enter the coupon code ORGVIEW when prompted during checkout. That's ORGVIEW. For more special offers, please visit our website at www.theorganicview.com. On today's show, as we continue our special series called The Neonicotinoid View, my special guest co-host Tom Theobald and I will be talking to Dr. Dave Goulson, professor of bumblebee ecology and conservation at the University of Sussex, about his research on bees and the impact of neonicotinoids. So I would first like to welcome to the show my special guest co-host, Mr. Tom Theobald. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hello, John.
And our guest today, Dr. Dave Goulson.
Good afternoon.
Dr. Goulson, could you please share a little bit about yourself for our listeners who are not familiar with your work?
I've been studying bumblebees mainly and other insects for the last 20 or so years, really trying to work out why many species were declining and what we could do about it.
Thank you. Can you also talk a little bit about your more recent studies?
Yeah, in the last 2 or 3 years, I've become quite interested in this whole neonicotinoid issue and what impact they might be having on our wild bees in particular. Much of the interest has been on honeybees, more famously, but there's every reason to believe that they might be having just as much or perhaps more impact on wild bees. So a couple of years ago, we published the first big bit of research we did on this, which seemed to show that bumblebee colonies that were exposed to the sorts of levels they might be exposed to if they were feeding on a canola crop, they produce way fewer queens, in fact 85% fewer queens, which was a pretty sort of striking result and would be pretty disastrous for bumblebees if this were routinely happening in the wild. And we've since been following that up with a range of other studies, the most recent of which is trying to work out why these nests produced far fewer queens. A suspicion has been, in fact, there's some good evidence from various studies, particularly on honeybees, that the low-level exposure to neonicotinoids doesn't necessarily kill bees, but it confuses or disorientates them. It makes them less well able to navigate or to gather food or whatever. So we wanted to look specifically at that, and this new bit of research that actually just came out a couple of days ago was done by one of my PhD students, Hannah Feltham. She, again, exposed bumblebee colonies to these low doses of neonics, imidacloprid, in fact, mimicking exposure to an oilseed rape crop, canola to you guys. And then she put these little, they're called RFID tags, radio frequency identification tags, which are little tiny kind of, it's a bit like a flight recorder for a bee, little tiny black cube that you glue onto the back of the bee. And it every time it comes in or out of its nest, it gets automatically logged on the computer, as it were. So we can track how long each bee goes out for. And we also weighed every bee as it went out and came back in so that we could calculate how much food it was carrying. And the key thing we found was that there seemed to be a big impact on their ability to collect pollen. So the bees exposed to pesticides, many fewer of them actually brought back any pollen at all. And those that did bring back pollen were carrying much less of it. So there was 57% less pollen coming into the colonies that were treated with pesticide compared to the untreated ones, which obviously could easily explain why in our previous studies we found far fewer queens being produced, because the pollen is the only source of protein that bees have to rear their offspring. And obviously, if you greatly reduce the availability of protein, then they can't rear as many offspring, they're not going to produce as many queens. And the whole thing ties together quite nicely. There's also actually other studies that suggest that there's a direct impact on the ability of bees to lay eggs when they're exposed to very low doses of neonics too. So it's probably not just the pollen collection that affects the colonies, but it's another piece of the jigsaw, if you like.
You have commented in the past on your concerns about the not only the neonicotinoids, but the vast number of chemicals that are applied in agriculture and urban situations. Could you expand upon that just a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah, I must admit I was rather taken aback. We recently, as part of a big project that's looking at these issues, we simply asked the local farmers, this is in southern United Kingdom, in Sussex, which is not a particularly intensively farmed part of the world, we asked them to tell us exactly what pesticides they were applying to their crops and when, and we could throughout a year. And it was pretty staggering, actually. I mean, so most of the crops they grow are canola or winter wheat, and most of them are treated with more than 20 different pesticides and a few fertilizers. In a single, so one crop in a single year may be treated with 20 or more different chemicals, including four or five insecticides, several herbicides, a whole range of fungicides, molluscicides, and so on. And when you think that bees feed on these crops, and that, of course, we then eat these crops, it's pretty concerning. I knew farming used pesticides, but I have to say, when you actually look at this long, long list of names of compounds that are being applied week after week, some of those 20-odd compounds being applied three or four times in the year, it's pretty concerning, and it raises questions as to what impacts this is having on ourselves, on bees, and on any wildlife living in agro-ecosystems. And there's a stark contrast between the reality of what wildlife is exposed to and the safety tests, the regulatory tests that are done on individual compounds to check whether they are going to do any harm when they're used. So the standard regulatory tests involve usually, if you have a new chemical you want to bring to market, you have to show that it's not going to kill bees and various other beneficial organisms. So typically you apply your chemical to, let's say, a honeybee, and you in a lab setting, and after 48 hours, if your bees aren't dead, then all is well. So in the regulatory tests, your test animals are exposed to one chemical for a short period. In the real world, they're being exposed to 20 or more chemicals. In fact, some recent studies looking at what agrochemicals are found in the food that honeybees have been gathering have found much higher numbers than 20, sometimes 30 or 40 different chemicals in a single nest. And the bees are being exposed to them 365 days of the year, not just for 48 hours. Essentially, the regulatory testing is utterly inappropriate to simulate anything like what actually happens in the real world.
Dr. Goldson, do you have any suggestions for modifying the current regulatory protocols so that the bees have more protection from these pesticides?
It actually is rather difficult to experimentally assess what exposing a bee to 30 different chemicals throughout its whole life is going to do to it. You know, one can't start pairwise every possible pair of chemicals doing tests, and then you've got three, you could try giving your bees three and four and so on. I think there's a different way of looking at it that I'd prefer, which is that I think there are big question marks over whether we need to be exposing bees to all these chemicals in the first place. Where is the evidence that we need to apply 22 chemicals to one field of canola? Actually, the evidence is largely lacking, and I strongly suspect that quite a few of the pesticides being applied are probably not necessary, and there's certainly no good evidence to show that they are. The bigger issue is the lack, particularly in Western Europe, of independent advice available to farmers as to which chemicals they should use. In the UK, almost all agronomists are employed by agrochemical companies. So they supply the seed, they supply the pesticides, they supply the fertilizers, and they supply the advice. And the farmers pay for all of this, clearly. But the farmers don't have anyone else to turn to for advice. So it's kind of inevitable that if all your farmer's advice is coming from a guy who sells agrochemicals, that he's going to be telling them to use a lot of agrochemicals, and they're probably using a lot more than they actually need to. And to me, that is an issue that we really need to tackle.
The world's attention has been focused on the neonicotinoids and more specifically on the actions that the European Union has taken. And there are many people who are concerned that, this is going to be a false lead because a two-year ban on only some of the crops is not likely to produce any results within 2 years. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, I completely agree. In fact, to call it a two-year ban is stretching it slightly. So they're still being widely used anyway on, for example, winter wheat, which is the biggest arable crop in the UK, is all still being treated. But anyway, so the ban does apply to these seed dressing uses of neonics on flowering crops, principally canola in the UK. And also that includes sunflowers, for example, in the rest of Europe. The ban came into effect in December 2013, so 2 months ago, and lasts for 2 years. But most of our arable crops are sown in the autumn. So in fact, all the arable crops that went into the ground in the autumn of 2013 were seed dressed with neonics. Even the flowering crops, because the ban hadn't come into effect. So this year, although it's the first year of the ban, is business as usual as far as the crops are concerned. All of our canola is going to have been treated with neonics. So the ban effectively, from a bee's perspective, won't come into effect until 2015. And the ban expires in December 2015. So we've only really got a one-year window to observe any amazing benefits. Now, I would confidently predict that that's nowhere near enough to be able to detect any improvement in our bee populations, be they honeybees or wild bees. But also, slightly bizarrely, although I applaud the EU for having brought in this ban, it's certainly a lot better than nothing, they haven't proposed any monitoring to go with it. So in fact, nobody is counting wild bee populations, bumblebees or anything else. So effectively we have what's really only a one-year ban and no monitoring. So of course we won't detect any benefits. Even if there were one, which I very much doubt, no one's counting anything to detect it.
Monitoring of another sort is of great concern here in the United States, and that has to do with the levels of contamination of groundwater and soils, and it seems that the regulators have very carefully avoided that kind of an assessment. What has been done in the UK? Do you have any baseline information as to the degree of the contamination?
We have very little. I've been trying to find out what kind of water screening goes on in the UK. And it seems it's essentially close to none. Likewise for soils, we have really no information on what's in the soil here, which is pretty alarming. In the Netherlands, there are now records of extremely high levels of neonics turning up in fresh water, in ditches and streams and ponds and so on. Enough in some instances, so I'm told, that you could basically pump the stuff out and use it as a pesticide. And there's been some scientific studies published last year that suggest that this is having a big impact on invertebrate communities in fresh water, which is hardly surprising. But for the UK, we have very little information. But one rather telling bit of research that we do have access to was actually done by Bayer Crop Science themselves in the UK a long time ago. So in the early 1990s, they conducted a trial to see whether imidacloprid accumulates in soil if you apply it annually. So they had experimental plots in East Anglia, northeast of London, and they sowed a winter wheat crop for 6 years in a row on the same fields. And the day before the next sowing, they sampled the levels of imidacloprid in the soil. I should have made clear that it's the winter wheat crop. It was with the seed dressing of imidacloprid. So every year they measured the concentration in the soil, and essentially it increased annually. They did this at two sites and with two levels of pesticide application. And at the end of 6 years, it had accumulated to quite alarming levels in the region of 50 to 60 parts per billion, which doesn't sound like much, but when you've been studying these things for a while, you realize that is more than enough to be doing a lot of harm to anything living in the soil, for example. So they did this study in the early 90s. It finished in 1996, if I recall. And it lay kind of buried. Nobody saw it for a long, long time. It only really came to light last year. But if that's representative of what's been happening in soils in Britain, in Europe, in North America, since neonics were introduced in the early 1990s, then there's every reason to expect there to be these things to be prevalent, to be everywhere, to be in all of our arable soils. In varying concentrations, and to be slowly leaching into waterways in low concentrations, which is pretty concerning. I mean, you can't help but kind of be reminded of the whole DDT situation from the 1960s.
Well, there's some recent information out of the University of Saskatchewan. They've been monitoring the prairie wetlands in Saskatchewan and have found pre-planting imidacloprid levels in the prairie wetlands as much as 100 times the legal limit.
Which
it's very
would be
concerning.
Indeed, and there are studies of the toxicity of neonics to aquatic insects such as mayflies and so on, and they show quite clearly that many of them are very, very susceptible, and the kind of concentrations you're talking about are not just exceeding the lethal dose, but are many fold times the lethal dose for some of the more sensitive insects. And when you think that these insects are the bottom of the food chain for a great number of other animals, particularly birds that depend on these wetlands for their food, then, you know, the potential consequences of this are very far-reaching.
Do you see any major objectives on the horizon? Major avenues of investigation?
Certainly from a UK perspective, we are currently trying to broaden the debate beyond bees to look at these bigger issues of environmental contamination and exactly what harm we may be doing to, for example, soil invertebrate communities that are really vital to maintaining healthy soil, and of course you need healthy soil if you're going to grow productive crops. So this is a, you know, potentially a really fundamental issue that we need to be sure that the way we're farming now isn't going to impair our ability to grow food into the future. And clearly, anything that accumulates in soil and is toxic doesn't sound like a great way to be going, and we need to investigate that in much more detail. At the moment, we really don't have much to go on, but these now nearly 20-year-old studies done by Bayer themselves. So we're looking at soil contamination and also trying to work out what other plants these pesticides may be getting into. So everyone's focused very much on the fact that they're in the crops, and if they're flowering crops, then bees will feed on them. But if they're in the soil and they're in the water, then they like to be being drawn up by, for example, hedgerow plants, trees, field margin wildflowers. And that then, again, has the potential to have all sorts of ramifications. So I think we really need to get to the bottom of what's the bigger picture rather than just focusing everything on these.
Dr. Goulson, you concluded a three-day conference in London about the impact of the neonicotinoids on bee health. Could you just give us a quick synopsis of what occurred and what your views may be on that?
Yeah, it was an interesting conference. It brought together quite a lot of scientists that have been working on this issue, mostly from Europe, but also some came over from the US, with industry and with representatives of the Farmers Union and so on. But we had folk from Syngenta and Bayer and the like there. And everyone expressed their views. Unfortunately, I don't. It would have been nice had we all been able to come to some kind of consensus, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. It was more a case of everyone becoming even more entrenched, I'm afraid. From my perspective, as someone who thinks the evidence is pretty convincing that neonics are harming bees, particularly bumblebees, the group I work on, I find it frustrating because I clearly, it's very hard to imagine a scenario in which the agrochemical industry are going to admit that this is the case. I think they will carry on denying it as long as they possibly, plausibly can, because clearly there's a huge amount of money at stake for them. The neonic sales are worth something in excess of $3 billion a year. So they're hardly going to roll over and say, yeah, you were right, these things are killing bees, we need to do something about it anytime soon. So unfortunately, there was no real coming together of minds at the end of the conference, I'm afraid, far from it.
Well, I think the main thing, Dr. Goulson, is that it was an opportunity to get both sides to come together to at least begin a discussion, even though it didn't necessarily result in a solution, at least, you know, it got the conversation going. So I think that's something that should be acknowledged, and I think that's you know, at least as a starting point.
I hope it didn't do any harm, at the very least.
I think getting the two sides to talk peacefully is, you know, that's how you can bring about change, by getting that conversation started. Dr. Goulson, would you care to share with our audience a little bit about your book that you have?
I would love to. I have a book called The Sting in the Tail, which came out in the UK in May, and it's broadly about bees, bumblebees in particular, and about the kind of amazing details of their lives. And it's also slightly autobiographical. It describes how I got into studying bees. And particularly, I started essentially when I was about seven, doing various strange things with them in my back garden as a kid. It's coming out in the US formally in May this year, which is very exciting, and I hope one or two people will buy it.
I think you'll have more than one or two people buying it, and I also hope that you will come back on the show to talk about the book in more detail.
I'd love to.
It would be a pleasure to have you back on. Dr. Goulson, thank you so much for being on the show today. And could you also share your blog information? I know it's very long.
I could. If anyone's at all interested in my views on pesticides, bees, and a whole host of other things, then my university homepage has a blog, which is www.sussex.ac.uk/LifeSci/GoulsonLab, GoulsonLab, /blog. I do apologize, that was so long. I don't suppose many people will have managed to catch it, but best I can do, I'm afraid.
Folks, in case you missed that link will be available on theorganicview.com. Dr. Goulson, thank you so much for being on the show, and also thank you, Tom, for also participating in the interview.
My pleasure.
I want to thank you for everything that you're doing as well. And Dr. Goulson, we all appreciate your work and the questions that you've raised and your willingness to speak out. Thank you very much.
No problem. At least I could do.
And folks, thank you for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.